Chris, we have a mountain of email here.
We really do.
Of questions that we could not get to at all because we have an hour. We have one limited time window to get to all these questions, and we just physically possibly can't. So I'm going to propose, if it's okay with you, that we attempt a rapid-fire episode.
That was awesome. Do it again. Do it one more time.
How's that sound? Our very first rapid-fire episode.
Sounds like a 1950s, like I don't know, you know, like not a modern gun.
No, it sounds like a very old gun. But I'm sure it's hard to record guns. I'll give those sound guys credit. But
you know what? I never thought about that. You're right. But you're right about the having lots of questions, too. And do not stop sending questions in. Do not let that deter you. I'm just saying we only get to about, I don't know, a maximum of 8, I'd say, questions per show. And a lot, oftentimes it's only 5 or 6. So we have a bit of a stockpile. And I even tweeted before, I was like, do not be deterred if we haven't gotten your question. We are going to get to it. And we're going to get to it by doing rapid fire episodes like this where we.
You said rapid fire.
Every time. Shows like this where we can just, it's just going to be me and Dave. No guests, no drama, no intro, just question and answer. Do as many as we can. And we will hopefully, through doing a couple of these, get caught up with the questions. So let's get it going.
Okay, let's load up the first question. Oh, that's crickets. All right. So, okay, load it up. The first one is from Anthony Edinger, and so let's just read it through. I've been a web developer for 15 years, starting out on front end with HTML, digging my way into the back end over my career. The past 5 years, I've focused solely on UI, mainly JavaScript, jQuery, CSS, and HTML. What should I focus on moving forward to keep up with the industry? I've seen several jobs that ask for CSS 3, HTML 5, but those are mostly mobile gaming companies. I'd like to stick to the website of things, perhaps mobile web development, but not related to gaming. It seems websites targeted at desktop are unable to take advantage of HTML5 and CSS3 as easily as mobile sites are because of the slow adoption of MSIE and all these newer technologies. So the question is, after he's been developing for 15 years, what should he be focusing on?
Yep. So first of all, kudos to you, dude. I mean, 15 years of experience is a long time in the web. That's basically the beginning of the web. You've been at this thing for a long time. You've basically got me beat, on paper anyway. I can't claim to have 15 years of web experience that way. So I think you'll be doing okay. There's a few weird things about this question to me. It seems like, gaming, like the jobs that you're finding that are referencing CSS3 and HTML5 our gaming companies. I would just say go to authenticjobs.com. I did it just before we started and I was looking at this question. There's 420 jobs there. Now they run the gamut from front end to back end, but it sounds like you have experience in both. Some of them are a turnoff to younger people because they say, oh, you need 10 years of experience. I don't have that. You do have that. So you're open to pretty much any job on there. Look through there. It's guaranteed you're going to find something that wants your skills with jQuery, HTML, and CSS. There are jobs for that type of thing, especially with people like you that have a good experience. So I think you're focusing on the right stuff. There's not some new acronym that you need to work on. If you're still keeping up to date on HTML, CSS, and jQuery, you're doing the right things. There are jobs out there for you. Just keep on keeping on, dude.
So yeah, I think he's in a great position. He's like a unicorn. He can do both front end and back end. He's in good shape, so he should definitely just keep applying. Or I don't even know if he's looking for a job, but I mean, just stay his course. CSS3, HTML5 are the wave of the future, so ride the wave. Sure.
Plus, you're obviously listening to this show, so that's a good step.
Yeah, by the fact that you're listening to this, you unlocked a badge somewhere. Next question.
Yeah, by Steve Sullivan, who asks, what are your thoughts on Google's Dart? So this is a little bit of an older question. It was all the rage, I don't know, maybe a month ago or a little more than that. If you don't know what it is, just Google Dart, I guess. Google Dart. It's not even really called Google Dart. It's just called Dart, and I don't even know if the page makes it obvious that Google's behind it. But at some point, it came out that there's some guys that work for Google that are part of the team that's working on it or something. It's a little bit like a JavaScript replacement, but I think it does some server-side stuff as well. What do you know about it, Dave?
So it's basically like a JavaScript compiler at this point. So you write stuff, you write Dart, and it turns into JavaScript, but it turns into a lot of JavaScript because Dart has all these helpers and stuff like that. But the goal is to be a JavaScript replacement eventually, so we'll all be writing Dart in the future. I don't necessarily think this is true. The syntax for Dart is ultimately a lot like C, the like computer language, mm-hmm. That's the reason I don't code in C, is because C looks like C. So that's why I use like web scripting languages. So I don't know if it has legs, but we'll just see what happens. Yeah.
I mean, there's some big backers behind it, and that's what's going to take at this point to get anywhere. So maybe there'll be, you know, if there's literally native support, it doesn't have to compile the JavaScript anymore, and there's multiple browsers behind it, maybe. But I would say don't work on it. I'd say the news about it seemed to fade out pretty quick. When it came out, it got slammed a bunch more than it got praised. It needs to have a very clear demonstration about why it's better than what we have now, which I'm not seeing. Yeah, and it's just, you know, we'll see. I wouldn't bet the farm on it is the point. Okay, let's give that up though. Next question.
Okay. There we go. Next question. It comes from Kevin Stevens. I'd like to hear some talk about the best, most clever ways to use before and after. Chris, I'm going to defer to you because you are the master of this.
I did do like a series of, like last year when I was at conferences and stuff, my talk was largely based on literally before and after the pseudo elements in CSS, that, you know, colon before and colon after, and how there is just literally a ton of cool stuff you can do with it. I have a post at csstricks.com/pseudo-element-roundup that covers a lot of them. It's like you can clear floats with them, and you can I'm just trying to think of a few random ones.
You can add corners or make triangles, and you can do tons of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if that's what you're into, just look at this post, because there's so many things. Yeah, you can create shapes. Imagine if you had, for every element on the page, you had two more elements that you could just toss in there without affecting the semantics of the page. You just have a div. Really, it's like you have three divs, and you can do whatever you want with those three divs without, you know, cluttering up your markup. So there's just so many cool things you can do with it. You would be surprised. So I would just defer to that link. Check that out, because it's basically literally the answer to your question. You want to know about clever things you can do with it? This post is all about clever things you can do with it. So reload.
Oh, here we go. Oh, wait, I'm typing. Okay, here we go. Next question comes from Esther H. I've seen Node.js and CoffeeScript written about as the coolest way to use CoffeeScript now, but I'm not really sure why or what they do other than other JS libraries. Can you give me an introduction?
I can start it just a little bit. I bet Dave knows a little bit more about this than me.
I do. So. I actually just picked up a Node book. Anyway, go ahead.
Nice. Okay. So, you know, she's her, I think it's a her, Esther. I would say that's a girl. We'll see. Node.js is server side JavaScript. And that's, I'll let Dave talk about that because he's got the new book on it. And then CoffeeScript, and they're just very different things. CoffeeScript is a preprocessor for JavaScript, meaning that you can write, somebody decided, I don't like the syntax of JavaScript. I'm going to reinvent the syntax, but what I write is going to be then preprocessed into real JavaScript that browsers can read. So that's what that is. That's a whole another world. Whereas Node.js is, I'll let Dave explain that. They're very different things.
Yeah. So Node is exactly what Chris said. It's a server side implementation of JavaScript. That means it's basically you're making JavaScript like PHP. That's a terrible analogy, but the things you do with PHP, you can now do with JavaScript on the server before it's sent over to the client. And that it's, you know, it's still in its infancy. It's like an 0.6 right now. And, but it's really nice. It's cool. And one cool thing you can do about Node is have multiple, there are these things called WebSockets, and this is going to get really advanced probably, but you can basically connect two computers to send messages to each other, or one computer to many computers, or vice versa. And the coolest like Node demo I've seen is these guys set up this socket IO connection. They had these four little circles on a screen, and they told everyone to go to a web address, and they said, drag this around. People are dragging on iPads and dragging on screens. And 70 people connected, and we're all dragging these circles around simultaneously. And I'm seeing it on my iPad. I'm seeing it on somebody else's computer. And it was incredible. So the future of Node is very bright right now. And if you like JavaScript, I recommend checking that out. And I will, I'm going to pitch a book. Is that okay? My friend Garen Means, she's a really talented developer here in Austin, and she just wrote a Node for front-end developers book, and it's on O'Reilly, and you can get the ebook. It's really a short book, so you can really just kind of get your intro real quick. So
cool. I would like to say that all the Node.js little tutorials you see in little examples are generally that they're like real-time chat or, you know, collaborative code editing and stuff. That's what Node.js is kind of best at. I don't know if I've seen a lot of like CMSs and stuff written in Node.js. You probably could, but it seems like there's things that Node is good at and things that Node probably isn't right for at the time. And just because you write in Node, it's not by itself able to deal with that real time aspect. Like Dave said, you need what's known as web sockets, right, and web workers and stuff to get that stuff done. Node by itself as a server side thing still needs fancy progressive new browser level stuff to allow that kind of open socket thing to work. Now, if just for a second, the way that a traditional web request works, right, over HTTP is just like I ask the server for some stuff and the server says, oh, here's some stuff, and it gives it back to you, and it's kind of this one-way back and forth exchange. And what would be cool is if, you know, we didn't need Node and stuff like that, there was a better protocol that would leave that connection open, and there was just communication back and forth constantly all the time that would make kind of modern day web stuff more able to do that. And unfortunately, all that type of stuff involves like pull and crap like that, and which just means continuously making requests over small time periods. And Node is trying to kind of solve that with this open connection thing. Did I explain that correctly?
I think you did. I think you got it. And then CoffeeScript, if you find JavaScript confusing, which is totally valid opinion, and all those function declarations redundant, then CoffeeScript is what you want to dive into, because it'll just... It's a really sexy syntax for JavaScript. There you go. Okay.
Got one here. Boom! Travis Barnett says, I've been using a PHP script with a lot of str replace to minify and cache control my CSS files. The result is one file and it's minified, but I'm not linking to that CSS file. Right now I'm linking to the PHP script. Does this require some server-side, you know, this does require some server-side processing, but it doesn't seem like much with a low-traffic site, but it's still something. Is that a best practice to store a minified CSS file, or is linking to that PHP script okay and allowable? I can answer that and say that we literally did that the way that you're describing it right there on wufoo.com for years and years and years. Literally, we told through htaccess file for our CSS files to be processed as PHP, and inside that CSS file, we would say we want this CSS file, this one, linked to like five different ones or so, and we did it that way so that mentally we could keep things separate. Say like, hey, I need grids, I need buttons, I need layout, I need dialogues, you know, so we could keep those CSS files separately, and then the main CSS file would grab those all, it would compress them individually, get rid of all the white space and comments and stuff, and then it would concatenate them, and then it would serve it as one file. Literally, PHP would process that on every single page request. And, you know, WFOOD serves a good amount of traffic. And it worked for us for a long, long time. So, yes, it does add server load, but I think it's pretty maintainable if you're on pretty serious hardware. That being said, we're off of that now. I mean, I would say as a best practice, not generally a super good idea. We're on preprocessors now. So all that same stuff where you're minifying it and concatenating it and compressing whatever, that stuff can all be done with preprocessors, which is definitely what I'd recommend now, just so that when you it's not a PHP script that you're linking to. You're literally linking to a CSS file that the browser can digest just how it is, and it's easier for it to cache that way too. So, you have anything to say about that, Dave?
I agree. I think a preprocessor is probably the direction you want to go. My code sniffer goes off when you say, you know, you're linking to template.css.php, and I'm just like, yeah, that should probably just be CSS. You know, CSS right. is pretty simple, so let's keep it simple.
Yeah, to have your server have to process, you know, something on every page load when it wouldn't have to do that, it's definitely better. I just want to say, though, that, you know, the code sniffer does go off. It certainly triggers off mine. I was shocked to find out, so we did it, but it did last on some pretty serious traffic for quite a long time. So it's not, you're not killing anybody. You're not.
Yeah, you're not tearing down the internet, but maybe check out preprocessors.
Yay.
Okay. Check. Next one is from Clinton Halpin. How do you go about planning a CSS PHP framework for multiple sites? This is a tough question.
Sure.
You have a post, though, on this, don't you, Chris, about like global area CSSs, kind of?
Yeah. Well,
you don't
yeah.
like that post anymore.
No, I might. I thought you were gonna refer to one I did on building your own CMS. I did like a series on that, and that's like dangerous territory. So a CSS/PHP framework is what Clinton is asking, and I'm like, those are weird two things to combine there. But there's such a thing as planning for how you're gonna deal with CSS. Maybe that's what Dave's referring to. I like the idea of design patterns and having a global file, you know, that affects all the pages of your site, and then maybe one more CSS file, kind of limit yourself to two CSS files on any page of your site and have that second CSS not be global but be specific to that area of the site you're in. That's fine. That's making decisions about how you're going to handle CSS through your site, which is a lot different than how you're going to handle, you know, your PHP framework. And yeah. Are you talking about building one from scratch, Clinton? Are you trying to pick one or what? You know, I'd say if you're just starting out and maybe you should look at CodeIgniter or maybe literally just like WordPress or something. If you're just looking for a PHP framework, rolling one, if you want to roll one yourself, I think you ought to have an awful good reason that you want to kind of reinvent the wheel like that. I'm not sure that's usually a good idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, especially PHP. There's, you know, CakePHP, CodeIgniter, Yokohama or something. There's just a million of them, and I would just go, if you're thinking about like rolling your own full framework, I'd maybe take a step back and investigate what's there.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And let it evolve too. Like, I don't know, Chris Epstein said in a couple episodes ago, he's talking about, you know, you start up your startup, you started off with no framework, then you start a framework started to evolve or whatever, and then you get to the point where it's pretty clear that a rewrite is going to be a good idea. Chris's advice for startup was stop and do it, you know, so that the future of working on this site is gonna be good to you. And he Clinton's also said about multiple sites here. Hopefully, what you can do is pick one that will work for multiple sites. If that's the number one thing you're concerned with, I would say you're going to be better off picking something like CakePHP or CodeIgniter. Because it's this base framework that you can start with, rather than building one site and this on this hand-rolled framework and then trying to abstract that away to do a different site when everything is so specific to that first site. Ugh, sounds gross.
Yeah. Code sniffer going off. Okay. Okay, next one is from Sukhjinder Singh, and he asks, how can Modernizer help CSS masters to have a site compatible in all browsers?
I think just asking how Modernizer works, you know, like if you're good at CSS, how can Modernizer help you? And I'm sure you've been just beaten beaten over the head with Modernizer. Every friggin' post out there is like, you should use Modernizer, 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 Modernizer. Every
I included it like four times in every project, just to be sure.
I know. I mean, are you guys sick of hearing about Modernizer yet? I hope so, because I'm not going to stop talking about it. It is extremely useful. Here's how I like to explain it, and this is less talked about, I think. For one thing, okay, first of all, I'm going to talk about this way. It's all about clean forking. You need to be able to just that was awesome. Was that your dog?
That was my dog. Let's just let her spin around and she's done. Okay, go ahead. Re-explain.
My doggy.
You were saying clean, it's all about forking?
Clean forking. So let's say you want to have box shadow on something on a site. Without Modernizer, you might just be like, I'm going to apply box shadow to this site, and I've decided that if the site doesn't have box shadow, that's fine. That's one way you could approach that code, right? Just be like, yeah, it's an older browser. It doesn't support box shadow. That's fine. It's not a big deal. But what if it is a big deal? What if you decide if it doesn't have box shadow, I want to do something like maybe put a border around it, because what I'm trying to do is emphasize it. Well, that's hard to make that fork in your code. It's hard to, you know, you need something to tell you if the browser supports box shadow so you can use box shadow, and if not, use border. And that's what Modernizer does. It will apply a class to the HTML element that says box shadow if it's available. That way you can start, you can write dot box shadow, and then whatever element you're trying to do, you can write a selector. It just allows you as a developer to cleanly fork what you're going to do, and that's not always easy to do just by letting it fall back. So that being said, there's another concept that does this kind of thing. It's called a polyfill. And polyfills are just write it how you're supposed to write it, be it JavaScript or CSS, whatever. And this polyfill will determine whether the browser you're in supports it or not. And if it doesn't, it will deal with it for you. It will find out some other way to make it work. Modernizer, you shouldn't use modernizers with polyfills. And I know that's a weird thing to say, but Modernizer just does the test. Whereas a good polyfill, the definition of polyfills, it already does the test. So don't do a test with Modernizer, and then if it fails the test, then load the polyfill. That doesn't make sense, because you're kind of doing the test twice. So anyway, that's just something to say. I that might be above the level that Sukhjinder was asking about. But I feel like that's not explained enough, is that if you find a good polyfill for a technology, just use the polyfill. You don't need to do a Modernizer test first.
Cool. Yeah, I think you get Modernizer is really, it just helps you write CSS based on browser capability rather than like if IE do this, you know. It's just gives you access to smarter CSS. So it's a tool. Let's use it. Next, Jen K is asking, I've looked at outputted HTML of a couple WordPress sites I did and started hating all the injected CSS and JavaScript. I think it generally looks ugly, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on code bloat you'd get from using lots of plugins. This actually is near and dear to my heart. Some of the plugin authors just do terrible things for WordPress plugins, which is, you know, some of that is you need to kind of vet your plugin vendors and make sure they're not abusing your site. That's one thing. But, you know, we all have to kind of get the job done. One thing you can do is jump into your functions PHP, and this is going to get crazy, but you can Google it, and Chris has a book about it. But you can jump into your functions PHP and start removing their functions that add CSS and JavaScript, and you can kind of write your own. So it's kind of cool. Or if you run it all through like a minifier or caching plugin, it'll all strip all that out as well.
Yes, good stuff there. Good stuff. So the example is, to backtrack a little bit, let's say you use a plugin like WP Polls, like CSS Trick does, because I want to load a poll on my site. That needs some JavaScript to work, and it needs some CSS to style it. And this plugin author is like, well, I need to get that on the page somehow. How am I going to get it on the page? Well, they use what's called hooks in WordPress, and they say in the hook that's called WP Head, which is a little PHP function that's pretty much on every WordPress theme, I'm going to inject a link that loads that CSS file, and I'll probably use the WP footer hook to inject the JavaScript that needs to go. And Jen is saying, if you have a lot of plugins, there can just be tons of that stuff. And that's totally contrary to everything you listen to about web performance and reducing the number of resources that a page loads. So what Dave is saying is go find the code in that WP Polls plugin and look, and you can do a search in that file for something like WP Head and see where it does an add action or whatever and links into that thing and adds its own CSS and remove that, but then grab the CSS that it was grabbing and put it in your main style sheet CSS. So that will remove that. It prettifies it up, which is, sounds like what you're worried about, and it reduces the number of requests, which is a great thing for performance. Now, that sucks when WP Polls updates. It's going to remove your custom thing. So that's a bummer there. Maybe a WordPress super duper expert could teach us how to override a plugin's functions with another plugin or something like that, so that you're safe to update WP Polls. Otherwise,
you can do that through remove action and the name of the action, and it's pretty awesome. I look into remove action. That's probably short.
There you go. So that way you're not customizing the PHP file that WP Polls comes with. You know what I'm saying? So you can update it freely.
Yeah.
Okay, but I totally feel you. Man, if you have too many plugins, you're loading all kinds of garbage. Some of them don't even link to a CSS file. They'll, like, inject a style block in the head, and then somebody views source on your site, and they're like, what is this jackwagon doing? Nice code, buddy, you know?
Yeah.
Even if you look at CSS Tricks, that stuff's there. And I clean it up, and then I switch plugins, and then it's back, and it's just a never-ending battle. But, okay, let's do it. Kaboom!
Next one, you got it?
Maulik Benjali. I have always faced this issue while using CSS opacity. It applies to all elements contained within that element to which you're applying opacity. Only the strange thing is I can't override the opacity of an inner element. Am I going wrong somewhere? Is that just the way it is? That's just the way it is, Malik. So let's say you have a header element and you want to fade it out for some reason. It's going to fade out not only that header element, but any headers you got inside it, any paragraph elements, buttons, whatever. Everything in that header is going to fade out when you fade out that header through a JavaScript, you know, like dot fade out or whatever, and it just has to be that way. That's why the spec designed it. It would be just, can you imagine the pain in the butt it would be that you have to fade out? It would only fade out that parent element, but it would leave that children in there with full opacity. So you have to, like, make sure to target every single thing with CSS or JavaScript and fade out all those things too. It just would be get way, way impractical. So that's the way they've written it, is that the nothing that's a child can be any less opacity than the parent. So if the parent is at 0.5 opacity, all the children are at least at 0.5 or more. And yes, that's just the way it is. Now, do you have anything to say about that before I keep?
Opacity is aggressive.
It is aggressive. Now, what Malik is probably what he's trying to do is he wants, like, the background to have a little opacity, but not the children, right? That is a perfectly valid thing, and that's why we have things like RGBA, so you can specify a flat color with RGB and an alpha, so you can have the background of that element, say, be like a faded out red, but not affect the opacity of any of those children things. The same thing with HSLA. Or let's say you have an image of a tree back there, and you want to fade out the tree a little bit. Well, that's hard to do because there's no such thing as background opacity, but that pseudo element post I mentioned earlier has a technique in it where you use a pseudo element, you absolutely position it to top left, bottom right, zero, so it's, the pseudo element is the exact same size as the element. Then with Z index, you move it behind the content, and you put a background image of that tree on the pseudo element, and then you can use opacity on the pseudo element. So it's kind of a way that you can get background opacity for free, kind of that way. So that's the answer. You can't use opacity. You got to use something else.
Yep. He nailed it. Background RGBA 0.5, and you're set up. You're moving. So
that's the one.
Boom. We nailed it. Okay. Next question is from Norris Perkis. Pukus, sorry, I'm totally messing
with that. Pukus.
Pukus, here we go.
It's an audio. Hey, Chris. How did you start CSS Tricks, and how did you find the time to work on the site and the screencasts?
Okay, Chris, I think I got this one.
Okay, hit it up.
Well, Chris hires friends to write. Nope, I don't got it. I was lying.
Well, thanks for listening to or watching the blog, Norris. It's one of those. We talked a little bit about Jeffrey Way in the Jeffrey Way episode, so check that out because somebody wanted to know how Jeffrey Way makes time to do all his stuff, which is just amazing. I'm sure all of us get this question sometime where they see, you know, we're writing articles and doing screencasts and have a full-time job and stuff. And yeah, you know. And the answer that we gave during the Jeffrey Way one is there's no secret to it. You know, you just get up and you kind of do stuff. So I'm sure that will come up from time to time. But, man, you got it in you too, Norris. You want to start a blog? Just do it, man. Just put your keys to the keyboard, start typing, and get it done. There's no secret to it. It's just getting up and working all day. That's all there is. Now, I have a few other advantages. I don't have any children and stuff like that. If you, you know, I imagine... some stuff like that can be a time sink that I don't have. But, you know,
yeah,
that's neither here nor there, I guess.
No, I think and for you, it's mostly like talk about stuff you've encountered, right? So you're just some of CSS Tricks is just blogging your experience. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and enjoying it, too. That's another thing we said in Jeffrey's thing. Like, I do this because I like doing it. I'm a little addicted to the community feedback, to be honest. I like hitting the publish button because people are going to read what I write. I mean, how amazing is that, you know? It's, every time I hit publish, I'm going to get some feedback. There's going to be some Twitter buzz. I'm going to be like, yeah, and that stuff is addictive, to be perfectly honest. You know, I'll enjoy that.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. Chris is a robot. Okay, moving on to...
Boom!
Oh, boom. Next question. This is from Raghavender Reddy. I would like to hear pros and cons of Blueprint CSS framework from you. I can chime in on that. We've used Blueprint for a lot of sites in the past. We used a lot of 960 for a while, and now, because Responsive is out, we're kind of rolling our own stuff. But there's a lot of pros and cons. Pro is every site you make is going to be the same. So when you hop into a site, it's going to be easy to understand what's happening. Cons, every site's going to be the same. Like your site structure is going to look the same on every single site you use, which is good and bad. Blueprint kind of specifies like typography and stuff like that, which is awesome. You should use that if you're, you know, sort of typographically hindered, like a little bit like myself. But yeah, I think it's a good one to start out with. I would also now look at Twitter's Bootstrap. Honestly, it's got a lot of what Blueprint had and a lot of what 960 had, and then it's got the Twitter seal of approval. So
I may just not have anything to say about this because I feel like I could come up with some stuff to say about how it might save you time, but you might not need it. And generic answers, and I don't like hearing my mouth say them because honestly, I've never used Blueprint. I've never used any CSS framework. I always hand roll, and it could be to my detriment. And I feel like in order to really comment out it, like I didn't like my mouth talking about preprocessors before I used it. So I feel like you got to really give it a go before you can have a really valid opinion on it. And since I've never really just used a real project and used Blueprint on it, I'm going to abstain.
Yeah, I think if you're doing a lot of client work, like get on a framework for sure. I mean, we've at Paravel, we've done hundreds, like seriously hundreds of client sites over the last 5-ish years or so. And being able to hop in to a site that I haven't touched in like 3 or 4 years and know what's happening, that's super valuable. So I don't have to like remember how I coded up this grid. It's just there. It's got a system. It's good for you. But yeah, there's a lot of value in hand rolling because you get what the project needs. So
yeah, I can see that. Let's see if you just don't get CSS layout and just need to get it done, I can see that being pretty useful too. Like if what you're going to write is going to suck compared to this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're building on the shoulders of a lot of smart people if you use a framework. So Nathan Smith from 960, genius guy. high five to him. But yeah, you just, they solve the problems and they present a solution. So it's cool. I think it's cool. Boom. There we go. Next one. Chris?
Yeah.
From
Samula Khan. I have applied transform rotate on a div container with some containing some text on hover. So they, you hover over a div with some text in it and it rotates a bit. Why, when I hover mouse over that div, the text blurs and then it goes back to sharp edges on mouse out? Is there a way to have a smooth effect? So yeah, here's the deal. It's going to be different. It's going to look different in Safari versus Chrome, even though they're WebKit. It's going to look different in Firefox. It's going to look different in Opera, all of which support transform rotate, but kind of they just, the text looks a little different in all of those different browsers. Now, where it like looks really different, you know, like the like really bad almost, you're like, whoa, that is not what I asked it to do. That's the I think in the territory of browser bug land. And I'm pretty sure I've seen some browser bugs on this. I'll try to dig them up for you so you can star them, which gives them more priority, or add your own test cases to it and stuff like that, which makes it easier for browser vendors to deal with. But yeah, when it's a really bad rotate and the text just looks like crap, I think that's something where you're not going to be able to do a hell of a lot about that. You'll probably need browsers to just get better in that. Or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. Sometimes the degrees that you're rotating matter. Like 7 degrees will look terrible, and you can go 7.2 or something, or 0.2, and it'll fix itself. That's worth trying out a little bit, not, you know, extremely, but gosh, yeah, it's kind of miserable when it happens. You just gotta be careful. It's not perfect yet.
Yeah. Okay. Boom.
Oh yeah. There we go. Next one.
When can we expect animatable pseudo elements in WebKit and other browsers? Now, I have a post on this. It's at csstricks.com/transitions and animations on CSS generated content. You can find it by Googling something. Basically, Google your question. It was written in August, I think, of last year, and now it's February. There are bugs filed for every single browser on this issue. Now, what he's asking is literally a pseudo element, like you have a div and then you say div after and then you put a little circle or a bit of text somewhere. That little after where you've applied that content, you can't
you can't transition a color or anything like that.
No, you can't do any of that stuff except in Firefox 4 Plus. So there you can. So you're good on that. Right. But literally every single other browser, you can't. And one time I was like mad about that and did a post that was just about this. I'm like, I'm going to track the progress of this. I'm going to link to the bug reports, and I want to be changing this blog post as much as I can. And you know, those bugs are just sitting there stagnant. Nobody's working on them. They're not even applied to any developers, as far as I can tell. There's just other things that they're working on. I know Chris Epstein just had a post the other day that's like, can we work as browser vendors and working group and stuff, can we work on some of this stuff rather than working on, you know, on like 3D transforms and stuff? Can we go back a little bit and patch some broken holes? Which I agree with. I like last year I was doing all these conferences talking about pseudo elements, and how much cooler could my talks have been if I could have used some CSS3 stuff on those pseudo elements. Way cooler is the answer. Anyway, so when can we expect it, Eliza? I don't know. I wish I could tell you. I wish I could tell the future. But we can. You can go to that post and go to those bug reports and star them or whatever. So you know, do a little bit about something, asking for browser vendors to get working on that. So sorry, I can't answer you completely, but that's what I got for you.
Yeah, squeaky wheel gets grease. So keep talking about it.
Good.
Okay. Point. Boom. Next one is from, this is our last one, I think. This is the last one I have on my list here. So it's from Jane Van. Hello, I wanted to know how to add pixel tracking in an email to be able to know how many people clicked my mails. Chris.
Okay. You know, pixel tracking is like you put a image with a like 1x1 pixel transparent GIF in there or whatever. And the reason that they do that is so that you can then parse your server logs and see how many times that image has been requested. So you can see, and then it's not only how many clicks, it's just how many times ever was that email looked at. So a lot of times that's how that stat is gathered, which is pretty interesting, and it makes sense, right? Because you can't put Google Analytics in an email that gets sent out or anything. So I'm not sure if that's exactly how like places like Campaign Monitor and MailChimp do that tracking or whatever, but if you really wanted to hand roll some tracking, that's how we do it. And how would you do that? I don't know. For one thing, you got to put the pixel in there. And the other thing is you got to learn how to parse server logs, which, you know, involves some grepping and stuff like that, which is kind of beyond my skill level, but that's how you would do it. Now, clicks is something different entirely. I would say if you want to track clicks on an email, just there's some kind of link. I'll try to dig it up for the show notes where you can craft a link that uses that appends like a question mark, you know, to add URL parameters and then adds a bunch of stuff to a link that Google Analytics knows about. And then whenever, you know, you send them to a page that has Google Analytics loaded on it, and then it like sees those URL parameters and is able to get stats on it, including what they clicked and where they came from and stuff like that. So I would do click tracking through Google Analytics and pixel tracking through who knows, you know, just put the pixel in the email and then worry about parsing the server logs later, I guess.
You could also write a PHP script that outputs an image that's like what it renders, and then you have it increment a database. But I'm going to guess that's going to be a little over the top. I would honestly just look into really robust services like MailChimp or Campaign Monitor, who do all this stuff for you, and then gives you charts and graphs and click-throughs and, you know, bounces and all these. If email tracking is like super important to you, this egg has been cracked.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I should have said that right away. I'm such a big fan of that, a big fan of, like, don't roll your own. Come on.
Yeah, you're just, well, it's a, you know, it's, I'm sure it's difficult, but I don't want to dissuade people. Maybe they've got Jane has the next big thing, and that's awesome. I think you'd have to get into some server rendering an image that also increments a database. So that's, it wouldn't be too hard, but I don't think it'd be fun. that's my response. So,
okay. That was the last one we had. I don't know. Yeah.
Rapid fire episode. That was really great. I think people need to keep sending in questions though. So we've got,
they really do. And we have more to do, but just don't be deterred. Keep them coming, guys. We love answering them. Hopefully this is useful to you guys, and we will get to your question. That's what I want to promise you for now. And if that ever changes, I'll tell you of that day where we're at the point where I can't guarantee answering every question. But as it is now, I promise you we're going to get to your question if you send it in. We will get to it at some point, unless it's just like in Japanese or something and I can't read it. Even then I'll try to Google Translate.
This is great. Yeah, no, we really appreciate everyone listening, sending in questions. It's you guys really fill the show, so thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye, guys. Okay. ShopTalkShow.com.